Hi, I'm Melanie Newman, and this is the Denfos Way. Let's go, birds.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this episode of the Denfos Way, a Department of Defense podcast developed and produced at the Defense Information School. This program is dedicated to developing and showcasing the skills of military communicators, public affairs professionals, and industry experts from all over the world. I'm your host, Jack Rouse. I'm a former Navy and civilian journalist and a current training specialist here at Denfos. I am very excited today to welcome Baltimore Orioles broadcaster Melanie Newman on the show. With a dynamic career in sports broadcasting, Melanie has made a name for herself as a trailblazer in Major League Baseball. She brings a wealth of experience, from calling live games to crafting compelling narratives that engage audiences. In this episode, Melanie will share her journey, the skills essential for successful broadcasting, and her insights on storytelling in sports. Join us as we dive into her experiences, challenges, and the lessons she's learned along the way, offering valuable takeaways for aspiring communicators in any field. Melanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I am a huge fan, both of yourself and of the Baltimore Orioles, so it's really great for me to have you on the show today. So if I fan out a little bit, please forgive me.
Well, I appreciate it. And I should add that my mother actually taught for the DOD, so this is kind of a really cool full circle moment for me as well.
Oh, that's awesome. What did she teach?
She was actually overseas in Russia and Germany for a while. She was actually on base with children. She had a specialist in special needs.
Oh, that's awesome. Very cool. So you have a little bit of experience with the military then, too.
A little.
Excellent. Well, if you don't mind, if we could just start with talking a little bit about your career and your journey into broadcasting and sort of how you got here and what inspired you to come into this career field.
Yeah, I always had an attachment to journalism. I think you start to notice with kids growing up, they either split into those two different brain functionalities of the math and science base or the language and applied arts. And the latter was definitely myself. I was a little introverted growing up, but I loved writing and exploring that end of journalism. I pursued it all throughout high school, was very lucky to be involved with our sports teams in that capacity as well. And by the time I got to college, thought that I was going to pursue written journalism until I actually had my advisor who suggested that he wanted me to completely flip and go into broadcasting, which at Troy University, there are two completely separate fields. You'll have some classes that overlap, but they do try to make them their own concentration. So for me to, again, growing up with a military background, you have people who have been there before, who have done the job professionally, and they're giving you advice, you're going to really take it and not question it. And so I followed it. I started to gradually come more and more out of my shell and found myself here, which has been just the most remarkable ride when I look back at it. I think I was 14 months out of college by the time I actually found my first job in the actual field. I was bartending and substitute teaching, whatever I could do to stay busy. And once I left to go to Kilgore, Texas, the roller coaster starts. It was 7 years in the minors until I finally made my way to the big leagues just in time for COVID to hit. But I wouldn't change any of it.
So what skills do you think are necessary for anybody who wants to be a successful broadcaster?
I think the biggest skill that gets overlooked is listening. Everybody always assumes the job is talking, but so much more of it is listening, and you're better when you're listening. I think everybody knows that you prepare questions when you're going in to sit down with somebody, but the biggest part of that is not getting ahead of yourself, because you can ask the first question and find a next question that's even better in their answer. But if you're not listening to their answer because you're just rolling, okay, this is the next one that I've got to come up with, I'm going to go to here, you're missing the point. The same thing when working with other on-air talent, you know, you have a greater ability to connect and bring out something special to the audience because you're listening to them. You're not just focusing on you or what's going on in front of you. You actually have to kind of lay aside the ego or whatever extra stuff you have going on in your head and just make sure that you're present with it. That was pushed to me really hard in school, and I'm really grateful that they did, because you do have those backup questions. You do still have to do the job, especially if, you know, you do get the occasional first answer that's just a flop and you've got to go right back to what you prepped. But I think there's really cool opportunities, especially to connect on a personal level when you just lay aside what you want to come out of your mouth and take in what they're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah, that active listening is incredibly important. How do you prepare for a broadcast? What is it that you do to make sure that you're prepared when you have to go on the air?
Yeah, so it's really two different styles of preparation depending on the role itself. If it's a hosting role versus if it's a play-by-play role. Play-by-play, obviously, you've got to have enough on every single person who could step on that field for the next 3 days. So you could have three items on their first baseman. That'll get you through one day. Now you need to get the next two or three down as well. I try to generally focus a mix on human interests in addition to the numbers, because what I've found, especially growing up in a household that was not keen on baseball after the 94 strike, was having that human relatability, because most people, and especially in today's economy, don't want to hear about somebody making $5 million. They don't know what it's like to throw 97 miles an hour, but they can relate to a lot of the backgrounds that these players still deal with. You know, it doesn't remove them from being human. And I think sometimes that can get lost unless you're going to take the time to really dig in and showcase that side. Now, on the other side of things with hosting, honestly, for me, and I know it's not the same for everybody, so I do not want to whitewash that, but hosting is such an easier role for me because, again, it comes back to majority listening. As long as I'm reading through the daily headlines, I try to go around the full league. That way, whatever they come up with, I can be prepared. And in the situation where it's an MLB Network broadcast, we're especially prepared because we've done a pre-production meeting where they will point blank tell us, these are the topics we're going to hit today. And then I can kind of further hone in if I decide I want to develop a certain opinion to generate a response from my two analysts, because they've either played or run the game for a long time. And it'll give them an ability to showcase their thought process and what makes them these professionals that we look up to so much. Then that's the direction I'm going to go for there. And on the reporting front, it's, again, more of the same. It's being in the clubhouse, asking questions, but making sure at the same time that you're not just approaching guys to only have an answer from them professionally, because otherwise they're going to understand that this is a transactional relationship. Sometimes it is taking 5 minutes to just ask how their kids are doing, or, you know, where they've been lately, if they've had some time off, what their rehab has been like, to touch base on a personal level that you have no intention for using on air, and in keeping the trust and just letting them know that, you know, you care about them more than the production that they're putting on the field.
So you hit on it a little bit there, but I want to dig a little deeper into it. You talked about how you try to focus on more than just the statistics and the numbers. So how important do you think is storytelling in broadcasting, and how do you kind of approach crafting those memorable narratives?
I think it's everything. When you look at the entire history of communication, not just in our country, but even beyond, the root of that communication does come back to storytelling. I mean, you can go back thousands and thousands of years. And yes, you had obviously the people who did keep the numbers and the historical figures and all that, but storytelling shapes so many cultures, the societies, the beliefs. You have whole religious structures based off of storytelling. And I think that's everything that we need to know, and how important it is to protect that from eroding, especially in today where all of the digital touch, the AI, the ability to not have to speak to anybody directly at all, really can disappear. And the more that we work on making sure that we're showing how to do it and why it's important and how much we love it, that should foster the next generation to love it just as much as us. But it takes work that most people don't see. You know, they think you just show up and start sharing all of these great things. But the sacrifice and the preparation is huge.
When you're handling those live broadcasts, what kind of challenges come from being live on the air as opposed to maybe producing those canned pieces?
Being ready for anything to happen is definitely, it's usually accepting that you cannot control most of what's going to happen on a live broadcast. I've actually found that, especially, so we'll have an open, you know, your 3 to 5 minute introduction, typically before any type of action starts. We're usually better when those are live, because I think, you know, in the back of your head, it's a one and done situation. You know, there is no taking it back, versus the canned. people get in their heads, especially if there's multiple that are trying to film it. You end up having to do multiple takes, but the rest, yeah, we actually just finished a live broadcast last week, and we had some hot mics and they got a little hotter. And at that point, you just have to roll with it and acknowledge that you're not going to be in trouble for whatever's just happened. But you do make light of it. You tear down the fourth wall a little bit. You show that you're a person. And I think it just, the more you can make people feel like they're sitting on the couch with you instead of you talking at them, the better the broadcast, for sure.
Absolutely. You mentioned it just briefly there, but obviously you're part of a team when you do these live broadcasts. How important is teamwork in your broadcasting and what you do with the Orioles?
A teamwork is everything, especially in the role that I serve right now. It's interesting because we do a double play-by-play instead of a play-by-play and analyst. When we're on radio, we obviously have one of the best Hall of Famers on TV. But so when you're doing double analyst work, you have to pick and choose which lanes you want to go into. And now we're lucky because naturally, all of our different combinations of people, we all have our very own style. There are a couple that are similar, but they're not really paired up that often. And so it does kind of create a natural lane, especially for me to focus on. We have a guy like Brett Hollander, who is a walking encyclopedia of the history of the Orioles. And so he's really great at these callbacks and these moments that are similar to what's happening in the game right now versus, again, I'll probably dip into the human side, and somewhere between the two of us, we'll pull up some numbers versus Jeff Arnold is very numbers. He used to be an umpire, so he'll go into the technicalities and the rules. It all just blends really, really nicely. And then on the other side with the other job, it's communicating with my play-by-play guy. And if there's something that he feels like wasn't talked about enough from last night's game, then that's my job to be downstairs to ask people about it and get further explanation. Whether he gets to use it or not, he'll at least have that knowledge to build on moving forward. And the same thing once I move in the dugout, it's constant listening to each other. If they can't see something from upstairs, I'm the one who's probably radioing behind the scenes of what exactly happened because I have the better view of it. It really never stops. And to say that is not even touching our production truck, because that's the true essence of teamwork. I've never seen anything like it in my life to walk in there where you have four people saying different directives at the same time, a million miles a minute. If fans saw for a moment any sports production truck and what it actually takes for these games to look the way they do on TV, where they just look so simple and smooth, it would blow their minds, because it's the job that I have so much respect for.
I always loved live directing and technical directing, but when I think about what it's like to be in that production truck, I think I'm happier on this side of the microphone.
Yeah.
What is it like working with somebody like Jim Palmer, who obviously is one of the best baseball players to ever live, but has also been a broadcaster for 30 years now? What is it like working with someone like that?
It's a gift that I don't think is appreciated enough. You know, Jim is going to be Jim. And the fun thing about him now is the older he gets, there's less filter. So you really will understand what he's thinking and feeling most of the time. And just to see somebody give 60 years of service to one organization is absolutely unheard of. But his memory recall is one of the more fantastic that I've ever seen in my life. I mean, every iota is still stored in his brain, and he can recall it at a moment's notice. He cares, you know. And to have someone to look up to like that, who's going to be honest with you, who, you know, can be a dad and can be on your case a little bit at the same time, which is never a bad thing. He's not appreciated enough. And I don't know that he ever will be appreciated enough. Anybody in a role like that who can serve that long and be that sharp. He doesn't have to work, but his brain wants to work. He needs to work. And we're just lucky every day that we get to be around him. And there's always going to be a new story that comes out of some niche of his life. We've actually played a game of just listing random people and places to see if he has a story. And so far, he has not had a story for us. And I think we even started listing like French dignitaries. And of course, he's met them at some point in time. So.
So you actually have been a part of some really significant firsts, and not only in the world of broadcasting, but Major League Baseball. And one of them I'd like to touch on is that you were the play-by-play announcer for the first female-led broadcast of a Major League Baseball game, where all of the announcers, the color commentary on the field were all women. And that was, first of all, an incredible thing to see. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was like?
It was honestly amazing. And I do want to have two different tracks to this, is that I feel lucky that they had options and they chose me because they didn't have to. I feel so fortunate, the women that they also paired me with, like Alana Rizzo, who has done this for decades, Sarah Langs to be my analyst, who again is one of the smartest women in the game I've ever met. Just really, really great people. And on the other side of the coin, what I think what people don't understand, again, we're gonna take you away from the easiness of seeing it on TV and the dirtiness behind the scenes, but still no travel for baseball. And so we had a game the night before. I think I wrapped up around 12:30 a.m., had to drive from Baltimore to New Jersey. The game was being played in Tampa, but we couldn't be on site for it. And so got into Jersey around 3 a.m., and then we were up early around 10 a.m. because the press tour started, the photos, everything else that we had to be a part of. Then actually calling the game at 7, wrapping up again around 1. I remember like screaming karaoke in my car just to like get me back home awake and in one piece. I think I crawled in bed at 4:30, and then I had to be back up at 5:30 because we had to talk to Good Morning America about the entire thing. I don't think Hoda loved that she asked how I felt about this magical, you know, first step for women. I said, I feel like I need coffee, because I was kind of in my own Palmer filterless mindset at that point. I was just trying to survive. And of course that game was at noon, so I couldn't even go back to bed after that. I had to go straight to the park, and I've had about 30 minutes of sleep, and my partner just looks at me and goes, man, you do not look good. I said, and that's why we're on radio. And we rolled through it from there. But all of that aside, I would do that 1,000 times over if it meant getting to be a part of that again, because it was fun. It is nerve wracking. And that was one of the first TV games that I'd ever called. So just really, really cool. But it's always going to have like the journey around it attached to it.
Oh, absolutely. I can imagine you'll be telling those stories for a very long time. So what advice would you give to aspiring broadcasters who are looking to get into the career field and have any kind of career similar to yours?
Yeah, I think especially the people who you're obviously working with are amongst some of the best for a very good reason. And that's because the work ethic is there. And that is something I've really tried to preach to this younger generation coming up, where again, everything looks so easy. And social media has made a lot easier in part, especially when you look at journalism, because you're building your own platform as early as you want. And what you do with that, if you choose to make it professional early, is entirely up to you. We didn't have that, obviously, growing up. I think YouTube was just becoming a more individual, user-friendly in terms of creating content by the time I was in the minors. So it's just the grunt work. You have to be willing to let it not be glamorous, let it not be well-paying, let it be tough hours. You sacrifice. And I know we're trying to turn away from this burnout culture and talking about work-life balance more. And I'm by no means against work-life balance. I don't think anybody should be against it. But there's also a recognition that these jobs still don't have that. And they probably never will have that, not in a perfect world, at least. The number of times I've packed up my tiny car and driven to cities that I've never heard of. And, you know, I've slept on couches or I've pushed enough money together to stay at a hotel for the sake of the job. More stuff that I just wouldn't trade. You have to be a little fearless in it. And instead of looking at it like you have to go to these places or you have to put up with these conditions, it's I get to. You know, you're only going to have so much time in your life where you're growing a little fearlessly and you get to see places you've never been before and you get to throw your hat in the ring and see how you stack up next to everybody else. You should be embracing the fear as part of where your feet are, and it really does become much more enjoyable after that. I had a couple years where I couldn't get in that mindset, and it's a slog if you kind of get stuck in that. And that's, I think, how a lot of people burn out. But be willing to be broke, be willing to be a little rootless for a while. I think it's fine if you have a hard list of places you absolutely won't go. But try to keep most of the map open for yourself and just figure the rest out along the way. It was the biggest thing I grew up with was my dad always telling us, you know, just chase what you love and you will figure out the money at some point. And you do.
That's awesome. Great advice from dad. What kind of mistakes do you see new communicators make, and how do you think they can avoid those kind of mistakes?
I honestly, the biggest one I see right now is a lack of professionalism in certain moments. And I think, again, social media tends to blur that at times. We've been kind of, it's tough, particularly for females, because you try to give advice that, hey, what you're putting out there, especially the clothing you wear, does stick for a long time. It does make an impression. And I'm not saying that you have to walk around in a turtleneck, but there are other options, obviously, that are, it's not a good look if what you're trying to sell is a professionalism and the appearance looks like you might be on Jersey Shore instead. And so seeing that and then bleeding out into watching them come to the field and they're not properly asking people for introductions or introducing themselves. There's kind of this air of arrogance and entitlement that they should be there. And then what happens is because they're not active listening, they're not asking remotely good questions. And the players and the coaches will react to that because they don't know who's there for a one-off or who's there full time. But if the questions come off uneducated or unprepared, they're going to pick up on that pretty quickly. And it's not always going to be met with sunshine and roses and patting you on the back, even though it wasn't good. They're going to be pretty honest about it. And so I think just encouraging both men and women to make sure that you're coming properly prepared, both physically and mentally, to the job, making sure that you're properly introducing yourself, especially if you see people that look like working media. I will be very blunt. I had someone walk up to me. They had a big chain on. They had an open jersey and these shorts. And it was all over the place. And I never got a, hello, my name is, or hi, do you work here? It just got, hey, my boy's not here to film this. Can you film it for me real quick? And just the lack of respect in that moment was so gobsmacking to me. And they also interrupted a conversation I was having with a player that I typically am all for helping, but I just turned and said, I'm really sorry, but I'm in the middle of something. And I hate that for them because that was a moment where we could have actually built a step towards, you know, hey, let's make sure this looks good for you. Let's help you out and get you somewhere. But I think you also start narrowing your time down to people who take the time seriously.
No, absolutely. What other challenges have you faced in the career field? You know, you mentioned how it was as a young broadcaster, and then you mentioned some things about being in a male-dominated industry. So what are some of the challenges that you faced and how you overcame them?
There have been a lot. I think it always shocks people to know the depth of how women are still treated, because they think it's, you know, the 2000s, and we've obviously moved past that for a long time now. And the reality was that most of my career in the minor leagues was held differently because I was a woman. My first 3 years, in fact, I wasn't allowed on the team bus. I had a boss who told me I wasn't allowed to talk to the players outside of our pregame interviews, which is really hard to be around someone all day, not speak to them, and then want something from them for 5 minutes. And they're not going to understand or reciprocate that relationship. And just trying to keep my tribe close to me for things like that and reminding me that, you know, that's not a reflection of my heart. I would rather talk to people. I would rather build those relationships. I'm there to do a job professionally and not for whatever reason these people believe. The people around you are important. At the end of the day, you're going to have to bet on yourself, because sometimes it will only be you believing that you can do this job, but the people around you will remind you of who you are at your core. I went from that situation to Texas, where after the first two road trips, the fan base basically said they felt uncomfortable that I was on the bus with the team, which, again, it's a professional bus ride, and also it's a bus. And so I was removed from road trips. And then I finally had a new boss at one point, and because she was a woman and she's been in sports, she started traveling with me so that I could be back on the road again. But once again, we were still having to drive ourselves. And this is 4 years after the first job that had the same kind of barrier put in place. It really wasn't until I hit 2019 and I had a general manager in Salem, Virginia, who just never asked one question about as a woman or because you're a woman, and frequently reminded me that they had my back and that I was going to have this job as long as I wanted to be a part of it. And that was really, really a gratifying moment, just to feel finally seen as an equal. As much as other people want to talk the talk, they don't walk the walk. And I don't think you can take it personally. Again, it's leaning into your inner circle and, sharing the struggles and how we cope with them. And sometimes you might scream at the wall for a minute and get it out of your system and you're good. And others, they might encourage you to have that conversation and to push people to start changing how they're reacting. But you just, at the end of the day, you can't take it personally.
You touched on this briefly earlier, but with the rise of social media, the rise of digital media, AI becoming something that's in the forefront of our thoughts in the field of communication, how do you see the future of broadcasting and what does it look like as it's evolving?
Man, I don't even know sometimes. And I think it's different too, because I've watched general broadcasting and how that has shifted. They've built platforms, they can live stream off of your phone. You can go on social media and see clips from different major media outlets. And then you look at sports and it's still a shifting iceberg and you're not really sure which direction it's going to go into yet. We've all been watching it. It's been a national story with how the regionals have reacted and reshaped and sold and changed and sold again. And those conversations are still being had and people are still trying to sort out what the future looks like. And we know that people still want to consume the content, but the problem is how the consumption is occurring is changing so drastically that these decades old huge infrastructures would have never been built to just change on a dime, especially at the rate that technology itself changes is the biggest challenge. And I don't envy the people who are in those control rooms at all, trying to put the pieces together here in this puzzle. It's encouraging to see fans, still wanting to be a part of it, still wanting to consume this stuff. And you just hope that at some point you can get to those models where you see access for everybody. I know that we hear about blackouts and stuff like that all the time, and it really just does come down to unification, very similar to the NFL, but obviously baseball in particular, because there's so much more in terms of games, it's still a bigger bear that you can't directly correlate NFL, NHL, or any of that. So I believe that they're working on it, and I believe that something will be down the road. And hopefully it'll start to regenerate those bigger numbers that we used to see in the 90s and the early 2000s when you had to tune in. We just saw the All-Star game this year actually had its largest crowd in Fox history, which to me is encouraging, but I guess it's just a wait and see at this point.
No, I agree with you. And we don't really know, obviously, we can't predict what's going to happen. But with the rise of digital media now and with our presences on social media and how easy it is to go live, for instance, and how to put information out there at an incredibly fast rate of speed, the industry is changing and we all sort of have to change along with it in order to be successful. And with that said, what kind of skills do you think are going to be most important for those broadcasters in the future?
I think if you can multitask and do it all, I've watched a couple of my former interns that are very efficient at churning out a news hit at 6, but they've also already built two different TikToks. They have the same hit available on their reels. They've pushed their professional Facebook page to start creating that. It's enviable, honestly. And there is a point where I've had to pick and choose the social media that I've wanted to develop just because I hate saying that, but it's already past me in some ways, just to keep up at the efficiency rate that she does because she's so used to it. So I think you have to be willing to multitask, to study and understand your algorithms, what is best in certain spots. So I'll see her newscast go out on an Instagram reel, but it'll be a get ready with me for the newscast on her TikTok, which it does sound silly, but employers are also looking at those numbers and that interaction and engagement. And so it does actually start to build into the job, even though it's something you're typically performing outside of job hours. But that being said, even though she's creating content, she's still putting in the work behind it. She's still having the sharpest, most there questions for both players and coaches. She's never going to be stumped when you meet her at an event on that event itself, because she's done the homework behind it. And I think that's what it comes down to, is you've got to be able to have that external appearance, but everything inside has to back it up. You have to have integrity behind it.
One of the skills that I think you're particularly good at is when you're co-hosting, and it's very difficult to have a good rapport with someone, to not interrupt them when they're talking, and et cetera. It's very difficult to host with other people. Can you speak a little bit to how you developed that skill and became so good at it?
Yeah, I think it again, we're going to circle back to active listening on this one. Mm-hmm. And I think especially when you only have, like, let's say two other hosts. So knowing their backgrounds, first of all, Googling them beforehand, mine are usually players or general managers. So knowing how long and when they played, what teams they were a part of, and maybe even what ultimately led to them retiring, stepping away, whatever, because you also never want to step into a situation where you sound ignorant and you bring up something that would be inflammatory towards them because you didn't take the time to learn who they were. I think as a kid who loved reading growing up, loved learning about different people, that's right up my alley to be a part of that. And then from there, and probably a reason that I thought I would pursue sociology for all of a semester, is just learning how people react and what pushes their buttons. At MLB Network, the analysts that I'm with are so, so diverse. It's really this cool challenge every time, because you'll get Anthony Recker for a moment, who can be a little quiet and reserved. And he's also got kind of a sensitive spot about his career was a little shorter, but he's still putting in the work. Like he could be a professional athlete today if he wanted. Dan O'Dowd is this kind of curmudgeon-y older GM, but he does have a soft spot for his daughter and he'll have hard opinions. Billy Ripken is just loud all the time. he's very much the opposite of Cal. And you kind of just have to go with him, because pushing against him can just get a little unhinged when you're on air together. And then you get guys like Chris Young and Carlos Pena, Jake Peavy. They're a little more similar to each other, but all in this very good wheelhouse of, they love listening, they love breaking down plays. They've always had my back, so they're also never going to put me, none of them ever put me in a bad spot. But in terms of relatability, I really, really get them. And then, yeah, you take all 20, and I've only mentioned six, and you kind of throw them up in the air and go, okay, these are your two for the day. And I don't know, it's just a really fun challenge. It goes back to that I get to, because it's not about me. It's about making sure that I'm directing all of the traffic and all of the elements that we're looking at and talking about to put these guys in the best spot to share their professional opinions. That's what fans are paying to see. It's not me, it is them. And I think that selfless mentality, same as a live game, it's not me, it's the players, it's Jim Palmer, it's Kevin Brown, making sure that they're set up to have those moments is what it comes back to.
How do you deal when you become the story? Just recently, I hate to bring it up, but just recently you were involved in a little bit of a foul ball mishap. And it became a larger story, obviously, than just you. So how do you deal when you become part of the story?
I don't love it because like we just talked about, I'm not supposed to be part of the story ever. It's always supposed to be me giving a voice to athletes, et cetera. But I do think it is, again, breaking down that fourth wall and just being a human, and, you know, talking about it, wearing it on the chin. Or the temple, wherever. And, you just take it as it is. The thing I hated the most about that is the player it occurred with is a player that I've worked around and with for 12 years. So I've known Rob Refsnyder a very, very long time. He is an absolute delight of a human being. And so I hated that it was somebody who I naturally root for in life. Because then, of course, I did watch it back afterwards, and I was very upset that he struck out. I felt like that was my fault. But, you know, he's a great guy. We talked about it afterwards, and we joked with the team. Like, they gave me a lot of street cred after that for coming back that night. And I was like, you know, I'm not athletic. I will never be athletic. But that was definitely one of the coolest moments, to get, like, a standing ovation at Fenway. Like, the only time that I would ever get that. And yeah, you have to be willing to kind of just laugh it off and go with it, and then let the story die as soon as, you know, that moment has passed, you've addressed it, you're good. Hey, let's get back to the game.
What inspires you and what keeps you motivated in such a demanding industry?
I think about my dad a lot, honestly. And he, after he passed, we found a note that he had written in his perfectly stick straight, all caps handwriting, just in his office. That was, how rare is it to have a female play-by-play in Major League Baseball? And then broke down these numbers of all these different people and all these different occupations. And we had it framed, and it's hanging on my wall in my office. And watching how hard he worked his whole life and how encouraging he was of a very non-traditional career for me was the greatest gift that I could ever be given. And so it always comes back to just giving him that honor and that ability to know that, like, I am putting out a good work at the end of the day. I'm representing the name well, because we always say, like, the guys play for the name on the front and the name on the back, and it's the same for us.
You have given me some really phenomenal answers during the course of this conversation, which I really appreciate. I've only got one more for you. What legacy do you hope to leave behind when you are done with this career?
Oh, man. I think at the end of the day, honestly, it's just to be in a place where we're not talking about gender in really any job. It's not even sports or broadcasting or anything like that. I think, as elementary as it sounds every time we bring it up, that it shouldn't have a factor in qualifying a person to do the job. We've both seen it. It still does come up, and it still does get circulated, and it does sit in the back of your mind. If I fail, they're going to judge the next female who tries to do the job that I'm doing. And as unfair as that is at times, it's the truth. And so I think just being able to finish this at the end of the day and seeing a little more actual true equality in these situations, and on the same side, not handing out jobs just because somebody's different, genuinely looking at all of the actual credentials that matter from person to person and picking the best qualified, is what this should always be about for every single person. And so just hopeful that, you know, we do have more than just myself and Jenny Kavnar and Susan Waldman. And it's not a discussion. It's not a big fanfare when she gets to make her debut. It's just that, hey, she's put in X, Y, and Z. This is her resume, and here she is. That would be the biggest gift at the end of the day, because, again, it is a privilege and it is a big honor to be in a spot like this, and I will always recognize that. But sometimes you just want to be a person. And so I just hope that that's what the next women get to see ultimately.
Melanie, thank you so much for your time. This was a truly fascinating conversation. I think you've given us some really great tips and advice for those young broadcasters just coming in the door who hope to replicate the amazing career you've had. So thank you again so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure's all mine.